Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, or it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, France 24, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Julian Assange has been released from a high-security prison in England, made to plead guilty to a single count of espionage, and returned home to Australia. Jamil Jaffer is the executive director of Knight's First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. He describes the deal that Julian had to agree to for his release. Jamil points out that the ruling will be used as a precedent in cases where a government wants to punish journalists for revealing information that they wish to keep secret, something that reporters do frequently. Jamil says that a free press needs to solicit information that can inform the populace of disinformation in, for example, press releases. And journalists do it all the time to the benefit of the public. Jamil says that he worries how future administrations will use the guilty plea to control journalists, human rights defenders, and whistleblowers. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
Julian Assange is free. That is how his platform WikiLeaks announced the end of a years-long standoff between the former hacker and the White House. Assange spent more than 10 years battling attempts to prosecute him for revealing classified U.S. documents. That publication made him a hero to some, but left him reviled by others. Whichever way people see Assange, it's cost him years of his freedom. Now, in a turn of events that surprised many, both sides have agreed to a plea deal that will allow Assange to walk free. He admits to violating the Espionage Act in return of a sentence of time already served in a British jail. And I'm pleased to welcome Jamil Jaffer. He's the executive director of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University in New York. Welcome to the day, Jamil. I want to ask you about the deal that Assange has agreed to. There have been mixed reactions to the fact that his deal would include an admission of guilt under the Espionage Act. What could that mean for press freedom?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit complicated. I mean, in some ways, it's a very good thing for press freedom that this case has been resolved in this way. You know, what we were really worried about was a judicial ruling from the United States, from a U.S. court, that said the solicitation of government secrets and the publication of government secrets violates the Espionage Act and isn't protected by the First Amendment. If we had got that kind of ruling from a court in the United States in this case, it would have had really far-reaching implications for press freedom, because those kinds of things, soliciting government secrets and publishing government secrets, are things that journalists do all the time and need to do all the time if they are going to play the role that our democracies need them to play. So we have avoided that, possibility, which is a very good thing. But we do have this plea agreement now in which Assange is agreeing to, you know, pleading to one count under the Espionage Act, you know, admitting that he violated the law by doing, again, the things that journalists do all the time. So there'll be this document that says that Assange was sentenced to 5 years in prison, you know, time served, but 5 years in prison for having done these things that are central to press freedom. So that's a real issue, and I think it means that the case will continue to have an effect on press freedom, not just in the United States, but even abroad. It'll cast a kind of shadow for the foreseeable future.
But Reporters Without Borders have called this a long overdue victory for journalism and press freedom. You don't agree with them then?
I think it's more complicated than that. It's a victory for Assange. It may be a victory for the Biden administration as well. It's a good thing that we avoided a judicial ruling in this case on the scope of the Espionage Act and the scope of the First Amendment, because nobody knows what that ruling might have said. But again, we do have Assange agreeing that he served 5 years in custody because he engaged in these acts. And these acts in this particular case are soliciting government secrets, publishing government secrets, the kinds of things that news organizations do every day and need to do every day. You can't hold government officials to account if you don't publish government secrets. You can't just tell the stories that government officials want you to tell if you're going to be a real journalist, as you know.
What do you think has led President Joe Biden to sign off on this?
Well, it's worth remembering that it wasn't the Biden administration that initiated this case. It was the Trump administration. The Trump administration filed the indictment after the Obama administration had concluded that the press freedom implications were just too significant, and it couldn't justify charging Assange, given that a victory against Assange would mean a very significant curtailing of press freedom. But the Trump administration went ahead because it saw the curtailment of press freedom as a kind of feature rather than a bug. And then the Biden administration pursued Assange's extradition. But the Biden administration, I don't think, was ever very enthusiastic about this case. They didn't want this to be part of their legacy. They didn't want to create a precedent that could be used against, say, the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal tomorrow. And so my guess is that the Biden administration will be very happy to have this case behind it.
Yeah. Assange's critics took great issue with WikiLeaks releasing non-redacted military secrets, claiming the potential risk that could have posed to the people involved. How do you feel about that part of his work?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to defend everything that Julian Assange did or that WikiLeaks did. You know, if I had been the editor of WikiLeaks at those particular times, I don't think I would have made the same publication decisions. But news organizations make news judgments all the time. WikiLeaks made news judgments. And, you know, the real question, I think, is what would it mean if the government could prosecute an organization on the basis that it solicited government secrets and published the secrets? Because that's really the question that's presented by the indictment. There is this important debate to be had, I think, about whether those news judgments were the right ones, were defensible ones, were ethical ones. I think that's an important debate. But I think the legal question presented by the case is much narrower. The legal question is, can somebody be thrown in prison for asking government officials to share secrets and then for publishing those secrets? And I think the answer to that has to be no. If it's not no, it's a real problem for journalism.
This entire saga that now looks like it's drawing to a close, what does it send to whistleblowers or investigative journalists?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as I said, I think the case is going to have a kind of legacy, because even though there's no judicial opinion endorsing the Justice Department's theories in this case, and again, it's a very good thing that there isn't one, but even though there is no judicial opinion, there is this plea deal in which both the Biden administration and Assange recognize that Assange served time in custody because he engaged in these acts. And I think that that is a precedent that some future American administration may cite to justify using the Espionage Act against a journalist. And it's a precedent that other governments may cite as well to justify using analogous laws against journalists or human rights activists or human rights researchers. So I don't think that, you know, we're going to be able to close the book on this case altogether. This case is going to have a legacy.
Jamil Jaffer of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University.
That interview is from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary, as well as at most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. Next, France 24. There's a proposal for a 2% minimum tax that would apply to about 3,000 of the world's richest people. The purpose is to balance out the fact that a great many of the wealthiest pay zero or close to zero in taxes because of shell companies and untaxed corporate stocks. The world this week is full of elections. In the UK, Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer debated over tax cuts and dealing with immigration. Labour is expected to win easily, ending 14 years of conservative rule. France is facing snap elections for parliament this week and next, which will determine the prime minister who will serve under President Macron. According to the latest polls, the far-right National Rally is expected to win. Valérie Decamp discusses the environmental threat of a far-right victory in the current French election. France 24.
I'm joined now by Yuka Roy from the Business Desk. Yuka, welcome to the program. About 3 years ago, a groundbreaking agreement was reached on imposing a global minimum tax on multinationals. Could the same be done then for super-rich individuals, do you think?
Well, the answer is yes, according to French economist Gabriel Zucman, the founder of the EU Tax Observatory, who just released a 50-page report on this idea. His proposal calls for a 2% minimum tax that would apply to about 3,000 of the world's richest people, and says that an international scheme to do so is technically feasible. The report was commissioned by the current G20 chair, Brazil, and will be examined at the group's finance ministers' meeting next month. The US doesn't support the idea, and Germany is sceptical. France has backed the idea, but with the election approaching, it's facing uncertainty. This is what the author of the report has to say.
Today, it's estimated that worldwide billionaires pay an average of 0.3% of their wealth in tax. Many pay zero or almost zero, and some pay a little more. Under my proposal, someone who already pays a lot of tax would pay nothing more, but a billionaire who pays zero tax today would have to pay an income tax surcharge of some kind to ensure that overall their taxes amount to at least 2% of their wealth. We don't need every country on the planet to apply this tax. We just need a critical mass of countries to say, OK, we're going to implement it.
OK, so tell us a little bit more about what's actually in this study.
Well, Zucman calculated how much tax revenue this kind of system could generate under different scenarios. For people with over $1 billion in net worth, a coordinated minimum tax at the rate of 2% would generate up to $242 billion annually, according to his calculations. Zucman says that the aim is to resolve what he said was the most unacceptable form of tax injustice, where billionaires have lower effective tax rate than the rest of the population. They're able to do so through tax optimization from holding most of their wealth in shell companies or in corporate stocks, which are not subject to taxation until they're sold. Many countries also have lower tax rates on dividends than salary. The report points to the fact that the wealth of the top 0.0001% of individuals has been growing twice as fast as that of the rest of the people and now accounts for about 14% of global GDP.
The final debate ahead of the UK election was a fiery exchange.
If you listen to people in the audience across the country more often, you might not be quite so out of touch.
Mark my words, your taxes are going up if he is in charge.
As Prime Minister Rishi Sunak desperately tried to claw back ground in the polls, he sought to accuse the Labour leader Keir Starmer of planning tax rises and of having a lax stance on illegal immigration.
Do you know where they come from? Iran,
you can see.
Syria, Afghanistan. So when Keir Starmer says he's going to return people, is he going to sit down? Are you going to sit down with the Iranian Ayatollahs? Are you going to try and do a deal with the Taliban? It's completely nonsensical what you are saying, right?
Sunak said if he wins, his plan is to deport some asylum seekers to Rwanda, but Starmer fired back, pointing to the record numbers of people that have come in on Sunak's watch. Sitting with a comfortable lead, the Labour Party leader focused on integrity, referring to the recent scandal involving Conservative Party officials having allegedly placed bets on the election date. He said he showed leadership where Sunak had not.
I think over the last 14 years, politics has become too much about self-entitlement and MPs thinking about what they can get for themselves. And one of the important choices and the thing that I would like to do if I'm elected Prime Minister is to reset politics so that politics returns to public service.
According to a YouGov snap poll after the debate, the two leaders tied in their performance, which will likely not be enough to sway the polls overall, that have Labour comfortably on track to win a majority and end 14 years of Conservative rule.
Well, we have been talking a lot on France 24 about the upcoming legislative election here in France. The first round, of course, is this Sunday, June 30th. And I'm going to dive a little bit deeper into that with our French politics editor, Mark Perlman, who joins me on the set. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Jane.
We were saying earlier that the far right is seeming, sounding very confident going into this vote. Are they right to be?
According to the latest polls, they are absolutely right to be confident. They've repeated, we need an absolute majority in the National Assembly to be able to really push through our program. And the latest polls we're seeing, the images right now, shows for the first time that they would indeed get this absolute majority in the National Assembly. The magic number is 289. Those are the number of seats you need to get an absolute majority. So if you look at this, the National Rally is polling between 230 and 270. However, a small key group is the alliance between the president of the Conservative Party, Eric Ciotti, who decided to leave essentially the party with some allies. And there, the alliance gives them 20 to 35 seats. So if you do the math, this means that the National Rally and its allies in parliament could indeed reach this absolute majority. This is only a poll. You see that the number of projected seats is varying quite a lot because those are 577 races. It's very difficult because it's a two-round election with a majority system. So it's very, very difficult to project. But it does show that just after the European election that prompted Emmanuel Macron to call for the snap election, they still have the momentum, and they're certainly hoping that this will be able, this will allow them to win round one and be in pole position for round two, and eventually get Jordan Bardella to Matignon, where the prime minister works.
Activists and scientists have raised their concerns about what a national rally victory might mean for the country's climate and environment policy. France's plans to expand renewable energy and move away from fossil fuels is under threat from Marine Le Pen's far-right nationalists, which have vowed to scrap some key environment policies. We're going to talk more about that now with our environment editor, Valerie DeCamp. Valerie, first of all, what do we know about their environment policies if they were to win a majority of seats?
Well, they regularly denounce what they call punitive green norms imposed by Brussels or Paris, which punish people, which are, in their view, detrimental to French voters. And this has pretty much become their trademark and a common thread in their policymaking. So if you look at their policy program, for example, when it comes to renewable energy, the party has vowed to end subsidies for wind power, cancel all wind power projects, and also even dismantle wind farms. They also have plans to abandon a ban on the sale of gasoline and diesel cars by 2035. This was something that was decided in Brussels. And they also have a plan to loosen housing renovation requirements, which make it illegal to rent an apartment that is not energy efficient, for example. So despite these measures, what's interesting is that the National Rally doesn't say that they want to abandon France's pledge to become carbon neutral by 2050. But according to the energy advisor of the party, they want to get there, but with different measures. This according to an interview that they recently gave. And so they want to focus on something different. They want to invest a lot on nuclear power, on nuclear reactors. And they also want to develop other fuels such as hydrogen. The problem, though, is that building new nuclear reactors, it will take years before they actually come onto the grid. And new fuels such as hydrogen, well, those are relatively on the experimental side of things for now. And that is why, you know, overall, the environment has taken a back seat during this campaign, even though, as you were saying, scientists and activists have, you know, raised alarm bells about what it could actually mean to have, the National Rally in power and whether it could lead to environmental rollbacks, as we saw just now. And I want to end with France's left-wing paper Libération, which dedicated its front page to this question of what it actually means a national rally in power. And their conclusion, their take was national rally, a vote against nature. So there you see how, French papers, some of them are reacting to what's happening now in France. We know, according to recent surveys, that 48% of national rally voters are skeptical about the role of humans in global warming. And it has also allowed them to attract new voters, because even though an overwhelming majority of people in France do believe that climate change is real, there's also the belief that the measures put forward in order to respond to the climate crisis, well, they were actually designed by the elite, by people, by urban elites who are disconnected, from the reality of people, perhaps in rural areas or in other parts of the country. And so that has certainly fed into the right-wing vote.
Those interviews and reports were from France 24. France 24 may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They're also available at most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the Shortwave Report or could help support this program, you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California 95490. There's a link for online support available at my website, outfarpress.com. Many thanks to everyone who has ever helped to keep this freely distributed show airborne. Please keep it up. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. The international aid group, Save the Children, released statistics about the plight of Palestinian children under siege in Gaza from Israel. Israel is using internationally banned white phosphorus as weapons in Lebanon, supplied by the United States. UN Secretary General Guterres spoke out against Israel expanding its war into Lebanon, as it could precipitate a much larger regional war. Radio Havana, Cuba.
The aid group Save the Children is estimating over 20,000 Palestinian children have gone missing during Israel's war on Gaza, with thousands separated from relatives or buried under the rubble. The government media office in Gaza says more than 17,000 children have been orphaned since the beginning of Israel's genocidal war on Palestinian territory more than 8 months ago. The media office released the figure on Monday, adding that 3% of the orphaned Gaza children have lost both of their parents. Meanwhile, Save the Children, a leading humanitarian organization for children, said in a statement that up to 21,000 Palestinian children are estimated to be missing in Israel's Gaza onslaught. The figure, it noted, includes at least 17,000 children who are believed to be unaccompanied and separated from their families, and approximately 4,000 children who are likely missing under the rubble. The charity further said that an unknown number of children are in mass graves, while others have been forcibly disappeared, including those detained and transferred out of Gaza. More than 14,000 Palestinian children have reportedly been killed in Gaza during months-long Israeli aggression. So far, the Tel Aviv regime has killed more than 37,598 Palestinians, mostly women and children, and injured over 86,032 others. Israeli forces in recent months have targeted forests and populated areas in southern Lebanon with intentionally banned white phosphorus bombs and munitions, local media reports said. Lebanon's official national news agency reported that the most recent attacks occurred near the town of Kafr Kila. The report further says the attacks endangered civilians' lives and caused massive fires in the region. Israel continues to use white phosphorus munitions in South Lebanon, causing lasting damage and driving villagers away. A series of reports have said that white phosphorus attacks are putting civilians at grave risk and contributing to displacement. A recent investigation by Qatar-based Al Jazeera found that Israel had dropped 117 phosphoric bombs on southern Lebanon, striking at least 32 towns and villages between October and March. On March 19th, Oxfam called on the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden to immediately suspend arms transfers to Israel. Israel reportedly used U.S.-supplied white phosphorus munitions in an October attack in southern Lebanon, according to a Washington Post investigation in December. Photos and videos verified by international rights groups and reviewed by the Post show the characteristic ribbons of white phosphorus smoke falling over Daira, a southern Lebanese village, on October 16. Loud production codes found on the shelves match the nomenclature used by the U.S. military to categorize domestically produced munitions, which show they were made by ammunition depots in Louisiana and Arkansas in 1989 and 1992, the report back then said. Lebanon has been urged to file a declaration with the International Criminal Court to enable an investigation and prosecution. Tensions remain high along Lebanon's southern border, where the Hezbollah resistance movement is engaged in intense clashes with Israeli forces.
The Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, expressed concern about Israel extending its war against the civilian population of the Gaza Strip to Lebanon, which would cause a regionalization of the war conflict. Numerous experts have pointed out that if Tel Aviv increases its attacks on other targets outside Gaza, inevitably, more countries, particularly Iran, will be forced to become involved in the war, which would have catastrophic consequences beyond the Middle East. According to Guterres, the risk of open conflict in that region is real and must be avoided. A false step, he added, can cause a catastrophe that goes beyond imagination, and it is time for the world to say loud and clear that war de-escalation is possible and essential. Extending the war will only ensure greater suffering and devastation for communities in Lebanon and Israel and potentially cause catastrophic effects across the region, the official said. An escalation beyond the enclave means internationalizing the conflict with serious consequences, especially if we take into account Israeli behavior, which is outside international regulations and conventions for causes of armed confrontations. It cannot be forgotten that it is a nuclear power that boasts of violating the norms established by the international community, including the inspection of its facilities and the declaration of the amount of its atomic arsenals, and of which no one guarantees that it is not willing to use them.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu. There's no podcast, however. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You will have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. On my website, you can also listen to past shows, find internet links for global news sources, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. While I'm recuperating from a spinal injury, I'm staying in a house that is connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.